Hello, I'm Derek Marinos. This is number 0242, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0242. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Brian Bishop, better known as Bald Brian from The Adam Carolla Show. He's also the author of Shrinkage, Manhood, Marriage, and the Tumor That Tried to Kill Me. How helpful was his sense of humor in fighting his cancer?
Pretty helpful. I mean, listen, being diagnosed with brain tumor at age 30 like I was is obviously a pretty heavy thing. So not letting your life be sort of dictated by the heaviness and the sadness and the despair and all that stuff, and mixing a little humor to sort of let some of the air out of the balloon once in a while. You know, it's just good to go through life, I think, with a sense of humor about things and not take things too seriously. And that's easier said than done, obviously, when your doctor tells you you got 6 months to live.
Matt Paxton, author of The Secret Lives of Hoarders. He goes in to clean up hoarders' homes. It's a huge task.
What do we do to fix it? That's the challenge. It's a mental disorder that looks very physical, and you think that the issue is the cleaning. The cleaning's not really the problem. The problem is the mental side of it. So we have to get them to therapy first. And then I do the most extreme houses. I mean, the worst homes in the world is what I get called in. So often we have to get them to therapy for 6 months to a year before we can even start cleaning.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and this time, Book Banter looks at the human side of Alzheimer's disease with Eric Rill's novel, An Absent Mind. It's a compelling book, and I'll talk about it shortly on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0242, was Derek Marinos. He's a journalist and also the owner of Komodo Media. You can check out his company at KomodoMedia.com. And thank you very, very much, Derek, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, when is an April Fool's joke not an April Fool's joke? When it's a story like this, which could also be the definition of a bad day. A senior living housing complex clerk by the name of Ronald Benjamin found a human shape lying on a patio when he stepped out for a smoke. Now, since it was April Fool's Day, he assumed it was a mannequin left out as a gag and ignored it. 2 hours later, another complex employee asked Benjamin about the shape, and he assured her that it was just a prank. It was when the newspaper boy and his mother came to deliver the papers and ask about the body, that's when Benjamin finally decided to do something about it. Enlisting the boy's help, they picked up the figure and chucked it into a nearby dumpster. Since this is the Stuff File program, I think you can guess where this story's going. It wasn't until later that night that a maintenance worker looked into the dumpster and realized that it was actually the body of a resident who had jumped to her death in the night. She jumped, like, from the 14th floor, actually left a suicide note. Yeah. I'm telling you, I swear to God, the face looked like a rubber mask, Benjamin told the press. If I thought for one instant that it was a real person, I would have called the police. Apparently, Benjamin has never touched a mannequin before, or probably for that matter, a woman. Fortunately for him, being an idiot is not a crime. Police say they believe his account and are not planning any criminal charges. However, Benjamin was fired from his position by the complex. Bet you he sues to get his job back. Wait and see. Wait and see. Anyway, moving right along, sheriff's deputies from Leon County and Franklin County, Florida, worked together at a traffic checkpoint and noticed a car turn so that it wouldn't have to go through. The driver wasn't wearing a seatbelt, which was enough cause to pull the car over, and a drug-sniffing dog alerted the cops to smells coming from the car. A search discovered 31.6 grams of cocaine, numerous other drugs, a set of digital scales, and $1,637 in cash. The driver, Paul W. Byrd Jr., age 63, was arrested, then released after paying a $28,000 bond. Byrd has resigned from his job. He was assistant superintendent of the Leon County School District. Wow. And had 29 years on the job. So what have we learned here, class? Well, apparently, wear your seatbelt. That's basically the whole thing that set this into motion. Wear your seatbelt. Wow. Moving right along, we have a story from Spain. You know, Paul Simon missed this one in his song 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. This is a fresh new kick. Spanish police are hoping to speak to a man who allegedly left a 21-year-old woman by the name of Adelia Aponte at the bottom of a well after she fell in while they were having sex. Aponte got stuck in the water at the bottom of a 15-foot hole for about a half hour after failing to notice that the wood covering the well's opening was loose. Police found out about the young woman's situation after they received an anonymous phone call alerting them about her whereabouts. It's possible that the man whom she had only just met that evening placed the call. If police are able to track him down, the man could be charged with failing to aid someone in need of assistance. Firefighters rescued Aponte from the well, and she was taken to a hospital and treated for hypothermia. It could have ended in tragedy, said a fire service spokesperson. Luckily for her, she could swim and wasn't knocked out as she fell in. So let me get this straight. This woman falls into a well and her paramour runs off and makes a call. I wonder if he also made a wish. Yeah. Carlos De Villa, age 34, was at the Maywood, Illinois courthouse for a hearing on a retail theft charge. Now, while there, he allegedly used a payphone to call in a bomb threat to the building that he was actually in. Sheriff's deputies were able to use security cameras to identify and apprehend De Villa. A search found, of course, no bombs. De Villa was charged with felony disorderly conduct and was held without bail. You know, he came very close to being this week's idiot of the day. Very close, but not close enough. We'll get to that a little later in the program. And, you know, the bigger question is, how long did it take for him to find a working payphone? You know, those are like spotting Bigfoot these days. Anyway, we have one more story to get to in this section of the Stuff File News before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A robber produced an apparent weapon at a Ladbrokes bookmaker shop in Glasgow, Scotland. Clerk Andrea McIntosh wasn't intimidated by the man, and she refused to hand over any money. A police officer who happened to also be in the shop then tackled the robber, disarmed him, and held him for responding officers. Gary Ruff, age 28, pleaded guilty to assault with intent to rob, but no firearm charges. His gun turned out to be a cucumber covered in a sock. As he was led away by police, Ruff was upset. He kept yelling, "It was a bleeping cucumber! Am I going to jail for this?" Yep, you idiot. You are going to jail. Isn't it great? Guess he got himself into a bit of a pickle, huh? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Brian Bishop, or Bald Brian as he's known to listeners of the Adam Carolla Show, is the show's sound effects czar and sidekick. He's also the author of Shrinkage, Manhood, Marriage, and the Tumor That Tried to Kill Me, which shares, in a humorous way, the very personal story of a medical situation that changed his life. Brian is on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Brian.
How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you for being on the program, sir. And first of all, I got to ask right off the bat, how are you? How are you?
It's funny. Usually you stand up to people and it's kind of like a throwaway line, like, hey, how's it going? But literally you're asking me how I am. I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. Feeling very good. Spoiler alert for the book, you know, the hero lives in the end, and I'm still here. So I'm doing very well, doing much better than I was doing a few years ago, and, you know, just keep getting better incrementally day by day. So feeling very good. and happy to be talking to you.
As you mentioned in the book, you came through this whole thing with a strong sense of humor. How helpful was that to you?
Pretty helpful. Listen, being diagnosed with brain tumor at age 30, like I was, is obviously a pretty heavy thing. So, not letting your life be sort of dictated by the heaviness and the sadness and the despair and all that stuff, and mixing a little humor to sort of let some of the air out of the balloon once in a while, it's just good to go through life, I think, with a sense of humor about things and not take things too seriously. And that's easier said than done, obviously, when your doctor tells you got 6 months to live. But what are you going to do? The situation is not going to change. Only your reaction is going to change. So do your best to live life with a smile.
Well, obviously, you've gotten past that situation. So getting literally a 6 month death sentence. What goes through your mind? I mean, do you put your affairs in order? Do you defiantly say, no, this is not going to happen? What do you do?
Yeah, well, first, when the doctor first said, the conversation was, he was giving me a lot of medical jargon about what I had and what I was dealing with. And I sort of cut to the chase and I was like, seriously, what are we looking at here? And he said, in these situations, typically I face 6 months to a year. And my first thought was, holy crap. And then, my second thought was, well, that's not going to be me. Whether that was foolish or not, that was just a thought that I had. And I think it was that moment that I was focused on, well, let's beat this thing as opposed to, well, let's get my affairs in order. And certainly the doctor, upon delivering my prognosis, said, he was like, if I were you, I'd get your affairs in order and blah, blah, blah. So it was pretty dire initially. And luckily I whether it's nurture or nature, I just had that, positive outlook, or at least I was willfully ignorant. I just sort of felt like, well, that wouldn't be me. I'd figure out a way around it.
Well, I was about to ask, generally speaking, are you a person who is a positive person?
Yeah, I think so. I think anyone who knows me would say that. Like anyone else, I'm prone to, feeling low once in a while, but especially when it's a situation that could go either way. Like I said, the situation is I've been diagnosed with, inoperable brain cancer, and the only thing that's going to change about that is my reaction to the situation. The situation itself is not going to be any different based on how I treat it, how I react. So the only thing you can control in that situation is your reaction, your behavior, I guess.
One of the things that's most difficult to deal with in a dire situation like that is not necessarily your own reaction, but the reaction of those around you, family and friends who don't know what to say or don't know what to do. Is someone like yourself who has a great sense of humor, is that disarming in a situation like that?
Are you asking if my sense of humor is disarming to the people around me?
Exactly.
I think it's actually kind of comforting in a way. I can specifically remember I was engaged at the time that I was diagnosed, and that's a big part of the book is going through with this whole wedding, rigmarole when you're facing, not only potentially deadly illness, but just the treatment aspect of it, chemotherapy and radiation and everything. And that's pretty heavy stuff to dump on top of an already stressful situation, which is, getting married. Anyone who's gotten married in any kind of medium to large size wedding, even a small wedding is really stressful. You have so much to deal with. So I can remember specifically from my bachelor party how my friends were, kind of walking on eggshells a little bit because they didn't know how much fun they were going to have or how much fun they were allowed to have or how much fun I was allowed to have. And luckily, after the first hour or so, I was acting normal and being my normal jokey self, and they all sort of got the cue. It's like, hey, this is a normal, as normal possible time as we're gonna have. So, but it can, your attitude, whether it's humorous or upbeat or positive or the opposite, whether it's dour or sad or whatever, is infectious. It's gonna infect the people around you, and if you're low and woe is me and everything sucks and I'm not as vulnerable now, people around you are going to have a similar reaction. And vice versa, if you're the opposite, people will sort of rise to the occasion.
You get this diagnosis from a doctor who gives you only 6 months to live. You say you have a positive attitude and that, you know, that's just not me. But there's got to be at least a little bit of doubt. However, at what point, because here you are today, you've got this book, you've got this life. At what point did you for certain absolutely realize, yeah, I'm definitely beating this? And when did you convince everyone else around you, including the doctors?
Boy, I wish there was one moment. It's such a series of moments. Anybody who's recovering from anything serious, whether it's a brain injury or cancer or surgery or anything that's major and serious, they know that recovery is incremental. It's so incremental, and it's frustrating sometimes. I talk about that in the book as well, whereas I wanted to wake up one morning and just feel better. I wanted to have that moment where things started to turn around, and it wasn't. It was a series of very, very, very small moments. I mean, there are milestones that I can certainly point to, like when I got my first, I would get MRIs every few months just to sort of track my tumor's progress. And I remember the first time we did the MRI after radiation and after chemo and after everything, and it showed that my tumor had shrunk by almost half. And it was a big, big moment, very emotional. My mom was there. My wife was there. It was a emotional moment for everyone. And I remember, even to this day, I haven't put my tumor behind me, my cancer behind me. It's always with me, and it'll always be a part of my life. But it's on the back burner. It's something that I live with and something that's always there. But what are you going to do? You got to go on and live your life. So there's a lot of those little moments, and, they all go in that, file cabinet in your mind of like, oh, this is something I've passed. This is a milestone I've accomplished, or this is a marker on the road that I've driven past. So it all sort of adds to one big moving on in my life.
You're a well-known person. You're on the show with Adam Carolla. People know who you are. So it's always nice to hear a positive story like this come out. But when you sat down and wrote the book, who were you really thinking your readers were going to be of your story?
Well, number one, I knew that fans of the show would be interested in the book because they knew a lot of my story, but not the whole thing. There's a lot, there's more than half in the book that I haven't even talked about before, probably. I also was very conscious that a lot of people would be buying this book or reading this book who had no idea who I was. Maybe someone gave it to them. I imagine this would be the kind of book that, if you're sitting around and you get the news that a good friend of yours has been diagnosed with cancer or a relative or whatever, and you have a very common reaction, which is, what can I do? What can I do to help? What can I do? And a lot of times, it's not obvious. Or there's nothing really major that you can do. It's a very helpless feeling. So I imagine that people who are familiar with this book would think, oh, this might be helpful to someone who's about to go through a situation like this. So I'm very cognizant of the fact that a lot of people who might be reading it have no idea who I am and don't really care. They just know that I'm someone who went through this situation and came on the other side. And then I guess there was also a part of my mind that was like, this book will, for better or worse, be sort of my legacy. And hopefully, if this is something that my children read someday, if we're lucky enough to have children, that they can sort of read it and understand what I went through and understand who I am and who their dad is or was or what he accomplished.
Even though, as you say in the book, there are some things you didn't talk about publicly at the time you were going through this, you did talk about some things. Did going public and talking about it, was it cathartic for you at the time? Reaction from people that you that got back to you after you talk about it, was that helpful to you at the time?
There was never really a question whether or not I would be public with my cancer treatment. I was diagnosed, and then I think it was a week later that I went on the podcast and started talking about it. It just never entered my mind that I would try and keep it a secret. I mean, when someone brought it up, like, oh, do you want to talk about this? I was like, well, of course. I mean, number one, when you're dealing with no one should have to, keep a secret like this to themselves. That's just such a heavy thing to weigh on your soul. Like, that's hard, and that is difficult. And when you're dealing with something this big, this sort of medical situation, you need all your resources, and sometimes your resources the support of people around you, whether they're fans of your show or they're just friends of friends or they're your personal friends and family, but you need to be firing on all cylinders. And I didn't want someday to be maybe, you know, walking down the street all skinny from chemotherapy and, you know, everything and looking horrible, and have someone who knew me from the show or recognized me, you know, think, oh my God, what happened to Brian? You know, and tweet a picture or something. That'd be horrible. So I didn't want to even open that up to the possibility. So it seemed so obvious to me to just be upfront and open with it. And I'm so glad I did, because immediately, and even to this day, I got dozens and dozens and dozens of emails and letters and everything just saying, hey, you know, thinking about you, you know, I don't know you, but I feel like I know you from your years on the radio and years on the podcast. And, you know, the support was overwhelming. It's a cliche, but, it was overwhelming. And it really helped me get through the initial tough time when I was just dealing with being diagnosed, you know. So really drew on that support from the fan base.
The book is called Shrinkage, Manhood, Marriage, and the Tumor That Tried to Kill Me. And we're so thankful that it only tried and did not succeed. I thank you very much, Brian, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Bishop, author of Shrinkage, Manhood, Marriage, and the Tumor That Tried to Kill Me. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0242, and you'll find the links to Brian's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Secret Lives of Hoarders, plus Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter, and of course there will indeed be an Idiot of the Day on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right back to the stuff, shall we? Okay, here is a story that speaks volumes about some of the pinheads that can be hired to do high-level security at airports in this post-9/11 world that we live in. I'll start with a quote. "I don't know if we can accept these." That's what Ashley Brand says a Transportation Security Administration agent in Phoenix, Arizona, told her. The identification she had presented an airport security was a driver's license, but it wasn't issued by a U.S. state, and that, the agent thought, might be a problem. "Do you have a U.S. passport?" Brandt says the agent yelled to a supervisor in another security line, and the supervisor said, yes, driver's licenses issued by Washington, D.C. qualify, even though the capital of the United States is not itself a state. Brandt's boyfriend tweeted the story, it went viral, and Guam and Puerto Rico residents began sharing similar stories. A TSA spokeswoman responded to a reporter's inquiry by pointing out the agency's website, which lists valid forms of ID, including state photo identity cards. Yeah. Oh, Lord. They are the first line of defense. We are all doomed. Meanwhile, it all started with a noise complaint, but when officers visited Frank Giardina's apartment in Queens, New York, he answered the door with a marijuana pipe in his hand, allegedly still emanating the telltale aroma of burning pot. The officer asked for identification to write a summons, and Frank invited the officer inside. Really? While Frank was looking for his ID, the officer saw what appeared to be about 5 pounds of heroin on the kitchen table. Frank was arrested, and police obtained a warrant to search the rest of the apartment. That search turned up 1,948 glassine bags of heroin. Frank was charged with first-degree criminal drug possession. You know, he would have gotten away with it, too, if it weren't for those meddling neighbors. Moral of the story? Keep the noise down. And apparently, life behind bars isn't so bad for the heinous, but they still want perks and advantages. We have a couple of stories that will make that point very clear and also probably make your hair stand on end. Story number one. James Degorski, age 41, serving life in prison for a cold-blooded mass murder during a botched restaurant robbery in Palatine, Illinois, in 1993, was awarded $451,000 by a jury recently after a prison guard punched him in the face, necessitating complex surgery. Said a parent of one of Degorski's victims, if broken bones are worth $500,000, how much are the 7 victims' lives worth? Good point. And story number two, former soccer star goalie Bruno Fernandes de Souza, age 28, serving 22 years in prison in Brazil for the murder of his girlfriend and feeding of part of her body to his dogs, was granted work release in March by prison officials with the work assignment, and I'm doing air quotes here now, being to play soccer for a Brazilian pro team that, upon learning of the rehabilitation law, signed him to a contract and urged his release. Does that soccer team have no shame? Yes, I know. Life isn't fair. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, when the Clay County, Florida Sheriff's Office received a complaint from a young girl that she was sexually assaulted by an older boy named Cody Williams, deputies arrested Cody Lee Williams, age 18, charged him with the sexual battery of a child younger than 12, and dumped him in jail. Williams had no idea what the charge was about, however, and the sheriff's deputy didn't bother to do a photo lineup to confirm Williams was the culprit. He wasn't. Investigators found that the alleged culprit was Cody Raymond Williams, age 18, who also goes to the same school as the other Cody Williams. Cody Lee spent 35 days in jail before the truth came out. 3 deputies have received reprimands, and the deputy considered most at fault, Johnny Hawkins, received a public reprimand from the sheriff. Here's a quote. As a result of your incompetence, an innocent man was arrested for an offense he did not commit. That was a quote from Sheriff Rick Bresler, who told this to him also in writing. Bessler also suspended Hawkins for 10 days and transferred him from jail duty to patrol. Oh, great. You know, there's an even higher percentage of innocents on the street. Do you want this clown in a patrol car amongst the general public? Yeah, I didn't think so. And do you think, by the way, that Cody Lee Williams is getting himself a good lawyer as we speak? 35 days in jail. It might be like hitting the lottery for him. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Hoarding has become a serious problem. In the United States alone, between 5 and 14 million people have been classified as compulsive hoarders. Matt Paxton has seen it all as a featured organizer on A&E's Hoarders, and he speaks nationally on hoarding and senior relocation. He's also the author of The Secret Lives of Hoarders, and he has a blog called 5decisionsaway.com. That's numerical 5decisionsaway.com. Matt joins us on the line right now. Hi, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. We were just talking just on the program last week to an organizer about just simple organizing, but we didn't get into the issue of hoarding, which is a much more serious situation. How does hoarding begin, and what do you do to convince people that this is not a healthy lifestyle and they've got to change?
So, I mean, to back it way up, hoarding happens for a reason. Nobody wakes up and says, I want to live in filth. Something horrible, tragic happens. They lose a family member. They lose their job. They get divorced. It's often multiple things. It's kind of what we call the trifecta. And if you look back on it, I mean, I'm in a person's house 20, 30 years later, and we often will pull a magazine out of the bottom of the pile and say, well, what happened in January 1981? And they'll tell you, oh, my dad died, and I lost my job, and my husband left. And so you know really quick what happened. What do we do to fix it? That's the challenge. It's a mental disorder that looks very physical, and you think that the issue is the cleaning. The cleaning's not really the problem. The problem is the mental side of it. And so we have to get them to therapy first and foremost. And then I do the most extreme houses, I mean the worst homes in the world is what I get called in. And so often we have to get them in therapy for 6 months to a year before we can even start cleaning successfully.
When you deal with this hoarding situation, are they aware that there's a problem? I mean, we see what we see when we walk into the house, or in this case, see and also smell when we walk into the house. Do they see it?
Yeah, I mean, most hoarders I work with, they see it, just like they don't see what you and I see, but they do know that there's a mess. The bigger issue is they're either in denial or they're not in denial, and the denial is the problem. I mean, it's pretty hard not to smell 300 cats. Let's be blunt. And it's pretty hard not to feel 300 cats running around your house. But you can totally be in a complete state of denial, and so you really don't act like you see it.
As you say, this is a mental disorder to start with, so you've got to deal with that. And I'm guessing the reason why this has to be dealt with is it's one thing for you to come in and clean up somebody's house. It's another thing for them to return to the situation they were in before the cleanup.
Yeah, I mean, it's 100% guaranteed. The house will go right back to the way it was if you don't get them in therapy. I can clean anything. That's not a problem. That's just muscle and a strong stomach. That's really easy. Keeping the house clean is the challenge, and that's when you have to get them involved. We call it faith, family, and friends. You got to get them involved with family again. You got to get involved with friends again. And they got to have faith in themselves, and hopefully they'll have some kind of faith in some kind of religion of some kind to get them through. But they have something that keeps them going, and in that mental side, we say therapy, and then obviously if they can, get an organizer as well.
Now, I mentioned your book, which is The Secret Lives of Hoarders, and it's that first part of it that I'm kind of curious in. Do most hoarders literally live in the shadows, live in secret?
Yeah, I think most people, they're really good at what they do. Most hoarders are they're in complete hiding, and it is a secret. And the ones you see on TV, I mean, they've hit rock bottom, and so they've had to ask for help. But there's over 10 million people just in America, and it might be North America, but there's over 10 million people that are affected by hoarding. And you know, they're really good at hiding. They're not gross, disgusting, filthy people. They are fascinating, interesting, often very amazing people that happen to be in hiding. They're doctors, lawyers, nurses, teachers. I mean, they're around us. They're your friends' mothers. I mean, they're not these crazy people. They're good, good people that just bad stuff has happened to.
Well, that's an interesting point because we often get this image of someone who is a shut-in of some kind, who doesn't go out into society and isn't part of the workforce. When you come across hoarders, is their work life totally different from their home life? And by that I mean, Are there people who have a clutter around their desk space at work or their workstation, but can't control it at home or vice versa?
I mean, a lot of them. That's a very broad question. It's not yes or no. A lot of them do. A lot of them go to work and they're actually able to keep it completely clean. Hoarding is a form of OCD. It's now its own separate mental disorder. It's got its own classification by the American Psychiatric Association. But it absolutely, you can keep it super, super clean at work, and then you get home and your house is a wreck. And it's not everyone that you think. The people you see me help on TV are the ones in the last, you know, the last year of a 30-year deal. But the people you're at work with, they're on year 10, 15, year 20.
I also mentioned you have a blog called 5decisionsaway.com, and that's numerical 5decisionsaway.com. What will people find when they go to that blog?
Well, we tell a lot of stories. It's a weekly podcast and some blogs that we just interesting, very blue-collar stories that we hear on the road talking to people. We clean the messiest homes in the country every week. And so it takes a certain type of humor to get through that if that's your job. I will warn your listeners, it is intense. Sometimes the stories are a bit much to take, so make sure you're able to handle it. But we a lot of hoarders love to hear our stories because they find out they're not alone, and they find out that we actually give them hope and we give them humor. Humor is often the best tool to get out of the lowest point in your life. It's very if you can't laugh at yourself, you can't get anywhere. Just so you know, me and my guys, we've all failed miserably at points in our lives. Most of us have been in jail. I had a severe gambling issue, lost everything, had to start over at 25. The guys that are the best at cleaning up the worst homes in the country tend to have some flavor in their life. They tend to have messed up themselves. And so our podcast and our blog really features that. We really embrace our failures, and we do that on purpose because it lets the hoarders know, hey, they're not alone. Life isn't so bad.
Well, that brings up an interesting point because I would assume in some cases when you go into somebody's house under these circumstances to clean up that they're, as you said earlier, aware of part of the problem that they have. And I would assume feel some sort of shame as to what they're having to go through and having to have someone, a stranger, come in and clean up after them.
The shame and the embarrassment is great. That means they're in reality and they're taking it for a very real situation. When they don't feel any shame and they're not embarrassed, that's when you're in concern because they're not ready yet. They haven't really come to terms with it. When they're really embarrassed, that's great because I know I can help them. And so we let them know right away. I mean, I've got two guys that were convicted murderers on my team on purpose because these guys did their 20 years. They're out now. They're good, clean, good people, and they work really hard. And the hoarders relate to them because they've made bigger mistakes than the hoarder ever could. Hoarder doesn't want to be looked down on. They don't want to be told they're filthy, they're lazy. They want to know that they're good people. And our guys, we share our personal failures. We share our personal lives on purpose. That's one of the tools we use because it lets them know that we're there with them side by side. We're not looking down on them.
Okay, so what about those, as you say, who don't realize they have a problem or don't think they have a problem? Can they be helped or do they need to hit their own rock bottom?
They need to hit rock bottom. If they're in complete denial, you really can't help them right then. Families often get very, we still clean houses all over North America, and families get really, really upset with us, and we turn them down. We say, well, your wife's not ready yet. She hasn't failed yet. She needs to hit rock bottom. And we are not cheap. I mean, it's an investment usually by the family to clean up these homes, and it would be unfair of us to take the money if these people aren't ready yet. And so we tell them often, like, look, you need to get them in therapy now. It might take 3 or 4 months before they get to reality. It's just the house will not stay clean if they're still in complete denial.
The tools that you used, as you said, to turn your life around and the people who have worked with you who have turned their lives around, are they very similar tools in helping these people turn their lives around who are hoarders?
Yeah, people were compassionate to us. People gave us a second chance. People didn't talk down to us. They treated us as equals. And those are the tools we use. I know it sounds really cheesy, but the main tools that are effective in cleaning a house that's full to the rim is compassion, trust, and respect.
When you uncover the stuff or clean out the stuff from a hoarder's house, I mean, a lot of time people think that it's, all trash and stuff they've been collecting they can't throw away. Do you ever actually find things of value?
Oh, yeah, man. We found gold. We found a box of gold bars the other day, man. About $2 million worth of gold. I mean, the family was last year, but I mean, the family was ecstatic. They didn't know that money was there. We find really cool things like artwork, We actually found a bag of love letters from a guy that had been dead for 50 years, and his wife was the hoarder, and we found all the love letters from her husband when they were courting, when they were like 18 during World War II. And, she sat there and just bawled because she thought those were gone. And she was there. We watched her read those letters all afternoon, and it was the coolest thing in the world. So not always monetarily valuable. Sometimes we do find a lot of things of monetary value, but sometimes we find just emotional value that is just, incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Amazing. The book is called The Secret Life of Hoarders. You could also go to Matt's blog, which is 5decisionsaway.com. That's numerical 5decisionsaway.com. Matt, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks for being here. If you've got anybody listening that needs help, tell them, please, please find us. We are there to help you anywhere in the country.
And people can go to the website, which is cluttercleaner.biz, correct?
Correct. Cluttercleaner.biz. No one's going to judge you. If you need help, give us a call, and we'll help you start it out.
Matt Paxton. He's the author of The Secret Lives of Hoarders. You can also check out his blog at 5decisionsaway.com and his website at cluttercleaner.biz. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0242, and you'll find links to Matt's sites, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. I'd like to tell you about one of the most important people in baseball who you've probably never heard of. Dr. Creighton Hale was a young college professor when, in 1955, he joined Little League Baseball to lead its safety efforts. He would eventually spend 50 years with the Little League, including 20 as its president. During that time, he invented some of the most important safety equipment used in the game today, including the double ear flap batter's helmet and the catcher's chest protector with throat guard. Let's be fair, I would have probably never heard of Dr. Hale if not for a speech he gave to Congress. You see, he went to Washington, D.C. to reveal how the lawsuit problem in America had affected his organization. He testified that it's become so bad that the Little League had to spend more money on liability insurance to protect itself from lawsuits than it spent on bats, balls, and gloves combined. How on earth did we ever let things get this way? Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, as you just heard, Stuart Nauman with another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Let's see. Let it roll down, down the highway.
Oh, somebody was watching the Junos, obviously.
I wasn't, but actually I'm just reminiscing about one of the many concerts I've been to in the 70s, particularly in 1976 at the old Place de Nation in Montreal, where I saw Backman Turner Overdrive.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. It was really, it was quite the show, actually.
And there's actually a reason why you brought this up, correct?
Yeah, because I like singing classic Canadian rock of the 1970s.
Uh-huh, right.
But no, really, on this, well, sort of, because on this edition of Book Banter, we're looking at a book by Randy Backman. Now, I know that Randy is a Canadian rock music icon thanks to his contributions as a member of two legendary Canadian rock groups, The Guess Who and Backman Turner Overdrive, or better known as BTO. But after reading his best-selling collection of behind-the-scenes stories that he shared with listeners on his weekly CBC radio program, Vinyl Tap, I never knew Backman had the penchant to tell a good story. So I was expecting the same mixture of stories that dealt with his years with both groups, his career as a rock musician, as well as his vast knowledge of music and musical instruments. And thankfully, with Tales from Beyond the Tap, I was not disappointed.
Well, I guess one of the reasons he could tell a good story, or the real one of the reasons you're surprised, rather, is that usually musicians don't remember a lot.
Yeah. I know it was lost between, let's say, 1969 and 1985 or something like that, and maybe little gaps afterwards if at best, but no, not with Randy Bachman. No. But with his second book, Tales from Beyond the Tap, it basically answers the questions that have been asked of him many times by the growing legion of listeners that he has. Bachman deals with such queries as the recordings that changed his life, the people who influenced his musical career, what was life on the road really like, the rock legends he would have liked to have met, what it takes to write and record songs, and some more memorable gigs that he performed over the past 5 decades. Now, he replies to these queries in the form of stories. And Bachman spares no details in answering these questions through a series of fascinating anecdotes and opinions. But what amazed me is how his passion for music has never wavered since he first took up the guitar in his native Winnipeg more than 50 years ago. And in fact, Bachman manages to make those certain chapters when he talks about his favorite guitars or how he what's favorite music, amps, or how he records a song, or what it takes to record a song. They're so reader friendly that even those who are not musically inclined will be fascinated by the instruments, methodology, and technology that are used to create and record music.
It's also good to learn about somebody's musical knowledge from the rock era, because so many people. You think back to what your parents said when you first listened to that, that noise upstairs in your room kind of thing, that there definitely was a method to the madness, so to speak, and a methodology behind it. And there was a lot of thought that went into it. And it's not just random people playing in their garage who don't comb their hair,
No, exactly. Because it's basically that knowledge and talent was developed over the years. And, and also if in order to survive in rock music, you have to, get with the new technologies, whether it be one track, two track, multi track recording, and that's what Randy Bachman did. He went with the times.
Actually, I take back part of what I just said, because one of the things about such musicians, the ones that we know so well, the ones that became popular, is that they made it look easy, even though there was such methodology to it, to the end point that we ended up with a lot of people in our neighborhood who wouldn't comb their hair. But and played in their garage, but were bad.
Yeah.
because they thought they could be Randy Bachman, but they had no chance.
No, just wannabes. Just wannabes.
Because they wouldn't put the work into it.
No, they just wanted the fame, the instant fame, and that was it.
Exactly.
Didn't want to commit the hard work and the hours in the studio that went along with and out with writing too.
So sort of like the Kim Kardashians of music.
Exactly.
Yes.
But also when you read this book, you're going to discover some aspects of Randy Bachman's life that may not have been common knowledge until you read this book. Like we learn about what was Bachman's career was like immediately after he left BTO in the late 70s. He set up another group called Iron Horse. Also about his on-again, off-again relationship with fellow Guess Who member Burton Cummings. And he says that if it wasn't for Cummings' unwillingness to change a music publishing deal with Bachman, the relationship would have been a lot warmer. And he talks about how the stardom in BTO affected the Bachman family, especially his brother Robbie, who was the group's drummer, who became the black sheep of the Bachman clan, mainly due to his misconstrued sense of entitlement and fame, even though he contributed very little to the group's development. In fact, he asked for a piece of the pie from Taking Care of Business, even though he played drums on the song and didn't even write it, didn't even help with the recording of it. He still wanted a piece of that music publishing action.
You make him sound like the Pete Best of BTO.
Yes, sort of, yeah. But yeah. there were no demonstrations like Robbie forever, Randy never. No. It wasn't like that.
Okay.
But in this book, Randy Bachman gives plenty of insights on how to thrive and survive in the rock music industry, let alone the Canadian rock music industry. And to paraphrase the title of one of BTO's hit songs from the mid '70s. Rock is his life. And believe me, let's hope that this vinyl tap full of great music and stories never runs dry.
And the book is?
Tales from Beyond the Tap by Randy Bachman, published by Viking, and it's $30.
And what do you recommend for others who might want to read similar type books?
Well, if you want to read a good rock memoir with a lot of great anecdotes and also a lot of great musical know-how and knowledge, read Keith Richards' book, Life, which was a total surprise, on the good, pleasantly, actually, a very pleasant surprise. Surprised he remembered so much to, you know, to warrant such a thick book.
Well, I was about to say, probably a surprise to him, too.
Yeah, probably. And also, Gene Simmons from Kiss, he wrote a memoir called Kiss and Makeup, and he's a very literate man. He was a teacher, a very intelligent man, and he's written a very fascinating inside look of what it was like to be part of Kiss, especially during his heyday during the 70s and 80s. And in fact, you know, all four members of Kiss have written memoirs about their life with the group. But excellent. Simmons was the first, and I think, to me, so far, it's the best one that I've read. Paul Stanley's coming out with his memoir very, very soon, actually. But that's Kiss and Makeup by Gene Simmons.
And, sir, how can people find you?
Well, you won't find me in the record store, that's for sure, or in iTunes, but you can find me in the Montreal Times every week, in print, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu, and sorry, but we haven't got any time for an encore.
Well, I guess so, but I will be taking care of business every day.
Okay. Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but first, a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you. In February, officials in Sudan seized at least 70 female sheep that had male sexual organs sewn on, the result of livestock smugglers trying to circumvent export restrictions. Ewes are valued more highly and their sale is limited. Authorities have been treating the inspections as routine until they spotted one ram, and I'm again doing air quotes, urinating from the female posture. Okay, who actually gets the task of sewing male organs onto a female sheep? I mean, gosh, he must be so proud of his work. Yeah. Anyway, Pia Farenkopf's mortgage was paid regularly. She'd set up an auto payment plan. Her mail didn't pile up. She arranged for it to be returned since she relied on the internet. Her lawn was mowed. She had a neighbor do it. And according to records, she even voted in 2010, but officials now think they got the paperwork wrong. It appears that in 2008, she got into her car in her garage in Pontiac, Michigan, and died. No, it wasn't suicide or anything. Her body had suffered no trauma, officials say. After Pia's bank account ran dry, her house went into foreclosure, and a bank contractor discovered a mummified corpse in her car. Officials are working to identify it. Pia had 9 siblings. "We have been looking for her," a nephew by the name of Eric Logan said. "We've done everything we could do, shy of us kicking the door ourselves." Which brings me to the question, why didn't you kick in the door? I mean, you hadn't heard from her for over 6 years. 9 siblings, 6 years, not hearing a peep. You know, contrary to what you might think, I'm not going to put the entire blame on the relatives completely. I mean, when you think about it, if nobody notices that you're missing, or worse yet, cares that you're missing, perhaps some of the problem lies with you. I'm just saying. A self-described devil-possessed Stephanie Hammond, age 23, was arrested in Churchill, Tennessee in March after driving her car through the front door of the Providence Church, then summoning her husband on the phone, and when he arrived, stabbed him in the chest for worshiping the NASCAR race that he'd been devoted to on TV that day. Yeah, how long do you think that anger was brewing up in her? And what's the deal with trying to drive through the church? Yeah. Meanwhile, police were called to a Taco Bell in South Carolina in March after one customer became so irate that another had audibly belched in the dining area yet had not said, "Excuse me." The enraged man jostled the burper with a chair and grabbed at his throat, but no arrest was made. That's the part that baffles me. No arrest was made. How does a guy not get arrested? Let me guess. Did he just simply say, "Oops, sorry"? Is that how it works? Wow. I don't know. Anyway, we're at that juncture in the program. You know what time it is, boys and girls? Yes, it's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff Off presents the Idiot of the Day.
Colton Green was arrested in Decatur, Illinois in March, shortly after a nearby Circle K gas station was robbed. Police said it was not a challenging caller in that Green was on probation and wearing an ankle monitor whose GPS trail placed him at the Circle K at the time of the robbery. Now why would someone who is already on probation and wearing an ankle monitor commit a holdup? Wow, one reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0242. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0242. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.